This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Hey everyone, this is Jody Sweetin from the podcast How Rude, Tanneritos. I've been needing a quick getaway with my family, and the 2024 Hyundai Santa Fe is the perfect vehicle to take us there. It has standard third row seating, so I'm able to pack my entire family, plus pets in the car, while also having enough room for our camping essentials. Available H-Track all-wheel drive will get us through any dirt trails, and available dual wireless charging pads will ensure we never have to worry about getting stuck with a dead phone in the middle of nowhere. Visit HyundaiUSA.com. or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
At JCPenney, fashion counts for everybody and every body. The weather is getting warmer and it's time to swap my winter layers for fun, vibrant, and cool clothing. With so many fun things happening this spring, like Mother's Day and the Wind Down Tour, it's hard to find great looking clothes that fit you just right. That's why I love JCPenney. JCPenney has so many stylish and comfortable options for so many different body types. I've been blown away by their selection, and everything hugs my body in all the right spots. Refresh your wardrobe this spring with style that gets you. Something to wear that fits your favorite moments of the season at prices that feel just as good. Discover brands that get you and put style and comfort first, like Worthington and Liz Claiborne for her, each in women's petite and plus sizes. Here, spring comes in all shapes, sizes, and colors. JCPenney, make everybody count.
School of Humans.
No, it's filthy and gross, disgusting. It's bacteria. That can be real bad and filthy, nasty stuff. And yeah, sure, some bacteria is very necessary for us as humans. We need that bacteria. So I'm acknowledging that. So all of you not all bacteria people, just back off. But for this episode, we're talking about one particularly nasty bacteria. It's the bacteria that causes what? Tuberculosis. TB. And this is the Halloween episode, so it does have a very spooky tie-in for this episode. But also, I'm calling it filthy so it connects to the whole theme of the show, right? American filth. Okay, what's filthy? Tuberculosis. Bacteria. Okay. So the fun fact about TB, such a fun fact. I don't know why I wrote fun fact, because it's not fun at all. But at the start of the 19th century, tuberculosis had killed 1 in 7 people who had ever lived. It's prolific. It's more influential than Jesus. But back in the day before the tuberculosis bacteria was identified, people called this disease the wasting disease, the white plague, the captain of death, and most commonly consumption. Because the way that tuberculosis works is it looks like it's consuming you. Like in photos of people who are dying of consumption, they looked emaciated. Their flesh was stretched across their skull. They just had like these hollowed out eyes. You're just like wasting away. One 18th century account described it this way, quote, "The emaciated figure strikes one with terror, the forehead covered with drops of sweat, the cheeks painted with a livid crimson, the eyes sunk, the breath offensive, quick and laborious, and the cough so incessant as to scarce allow the wretched sufferer time to tell his complaints." And yeah, so the way that TB works is the bacteria will get into your lungs. So basically you like cough yourself to death. You just be really tired, hacking up blood. It also can attack other parts of your body, your brain, your kidney, your spine. And you never know. You could get TB and then die quickly, or you could feel terrible for years before you perish. But perish you would. Before the 20th century, if you had TB, if you had consumption, it was basically a death sentence. It seemed that about 80% of people who fell ill would die. And before the scientist Robert Koch discovered the tuberculosis bacterium in the 1880s, people just didn't know what caused it. A lot of people thought it was genetic, because often whole families would die, just one right after the other. The idea of things being contagious wasn't really around yet. Germ theory was just a fun and flirty idea at the time, not a science people believed and understood. And there wasn't a cure, so people were getting pretty creative with their treatments. Like in rural New England in the 18th and 19th centuries, one remedy that people practiced was they would dig up their dead relatives who had died of consumption, mutilate their bodies, and sometimes cannibalize them. Because they thought they were vampires. Duh. Cue the theme music. This is American Filth. I'm Gabby Watts. Every week I tell you a filthy story from American history on today's Halloween episode, Vampires in New England. Sorry for that accent. I don't know where it came from. All right, we're going to get into further back history, but we're going to start a little more recent. So in 1990, there were some kids playing outside in Griswold, Connecticut. And while they were playing, they found, whoopsie, some dead people. One kid ran home and told his parents about the dead people. And they're like, I don't believe you. So he went back and got a skull and was like, here. And they're like, oh, shit. Okay. And it ended up there wasn't just one dead guy. There's a whole cemetery filled with dead people. And at first, everyone was like, oh no, maybe these dead bodies are the victims of our local serial killer, Michael Ross. But no, don't worry. They consulted the state of Connecticut's archaeologist, and he found that these bodies in the cemetery were much older. They went back all the way to the 1700s through the 1800s, and it looked like it was a family cemetery. There are 29 bodies in total, many of them children. You don't even need to know that detail, but I included it because it's very morbid. And most of the people buried in the cemetery were buried in a very normal, traditional style. They were buried in simple wooden coffins and laid to rest with their arms by their sides or crossed over their arms, whatever you were feeling that day. But there was one coffin that stood out. Unlike the others, it was painted red, and on the lid, there were some tacks that spelled out JB-55. This dead dude was later identified as John Barber. He was a farmer who had died at the age of 55, hence JB-55. And the thing that was really freaky-deaky about Johnny B was that his femurs had been removed from their usual place, you know, in the legs, and placed in a cross underneath the skull, making a sort of skull and crossbones orientation, which indicates that at some point he was decapitated. And there's more. The ribs were broken, as if someone had smashed through his chest looking for something. And luckily, you know, based on what the archaeologist found, he was not alive when these injuries happened. I mean, obviously, it would be hard to stay alive after a decapitation. But what they think happened is that JB-55, he died of consumption in the year 1830-ish. And then soon after, or maybe some years later, other family members started dying of consumption. And they were like, well, the reason this is happening is because our dead relative JB is actually a vampire. And he's maintaining some semblance of life underground by draining our vital life force. That's right, a vamp, just sucking the life out of them. That's crazy, because like my family members aren't even dead and they already suck my life away. I'm just kidding, Mom. But this vampire belief, that was common throughout the region, specifically Connecticut, Rhode Island, Vermont, Massachusetts. And kind of here's the gist of this folkloric belief from a paper that archaeologist published. Quote, following the death of a family member from consumption, i.e. tuberculosis, other family members began to show signs of tuberculosis infection. According to the New England folk belief, the wasting away of these family members was attributed to the recently deceased consumptive, who returned from the dead as a vampire to drain the life from the surviving members. The remedy used to kill the vampire was to exhume the body of the supposed vampire, and if the body was undecomposed, remove and burn the blood-filled heart or the entire body. And these vampires, they weren't like Dracula, obviously, because, I mean, they don't sound very sexy. No offense, JB-55. And Dracula, it hadn't even been written at this point. the way I'm imagining it, it's less of like a sexy ghoul sneaking up on you and then biting you. It's more like these vampires would just like, they'd be vibing in the ground, you know, kind of like an energy vampire or something. Like they're snatching vibes, like the vital life force vibe in your blood, basically. So yeah, as everyone's saying, in order to kill the vampire, you had to mess up its body really good. So let's go back to JB and what happened to him. What they probably did is they probably pulled out his coffin, ripped open the lid, smashed through his ribs to snatch out his organs that still had blood in them, burned those. Then they pulled off his head and then put the femurs between the head and the rest of the body. Because, I mean, if you really want a vampire to stop attacking you, you got to make sure he doesn't got access to his head, you know? And there's dozens of other bodies that have been exhumed throughout New England that kind of show this same trend of people digging up their relatives and then massacring their bodies. It seemed that the most chill method that people would do is they would just simply turn the body over. Other times, you know, they decapitate the body. Most commonly, they were just taking out the undecomposed organs and burning them. And then sometimes, to be extra safe, they would just burn the whole thing. Here's another fun example from 1854 in Jewett City, Connecticut. There was a family, and the dad, Horace Ray, died, and then afterwards two of his other sons died, and then the next year, his other son started coming down with consumption, so they were like, well, I guess to make sure he doesn't die, we'll just dig up the two brothers and then burn them. So that's what they did. Everyone in Jewett City came out to watch these bodies get burned up. It's just a very cursed bonfire. Like, can you imagine just being like, hey, friends, come over on Saturday. I'm burning the bodies of my relatives who died a few years ago because they're feeding on me and I don't want to die. BYOB, bring your own body. Another thing that would happen in the cases where they'd burn up the bodies or even just the organs, often the people who were doing that, they would try to inhale the smoke to cleanse themselves and prevent the disease. Another thing that would happen is whoever was inflicted with a disease, they would take the ashes and then they would mix them up in water and drink them down. You know, just cannibalizing your dead sister, brother, mother, father, wife, husband, etc. Because this would allegedly protect you from dying of the illness. And I think I should say, guys, obviously this didn't prevent anyone from dying. In case you're about to dig up your dead grandma because you think she's giving you ADHD, no, that's just you. But the belief was pretty common, particularly among the poor people in New England, but sometimes even the rich people believed it. Like in 1817, there was a dude named Frederick Ransom, and he was a Dartmouth student from Vermont. He died of consumption, and then a lot of his other family members had consumption, so they exhumed him, they took out his heart, they burned it in a blacksmith's forge. And one of his brothers was later like, well, it didn't help. My mother, sister, and two other brothers died, but here I am, all alone. I will say that burning your dead family members, I feel like that's a step up for New England. Like, it does feel better than just, like, burning and hanging women who are alive who you think are witches, you know? Throughout the 19th century, cases of tuberculosis had declined in New England, but this folkloric belief did continue. Because despite, you know, germ theory becoming the thing, that just wasn't information that was available to a lot of people. And then a lot of people outside of New England heard about this because of this one specific case in 1892. So let's go to Exeter, Rhode Island. Rhode Island, if you didn't know, is a state. And let's go to the most popular case of vampirism, Mercy Lena Brown. Be right back after these soothing ads.
At JCPenney, fashion counts for everybody and everybody. It's spring, and with the weather changing and so many great things coming up like Mother's Day and the Wind Down Tour, I definitely need a fresh spring wardrobe for every occasion. This spring, I'm looking for that perfect flowy spring dress for Mother's Day, as well as replacing my everyday basics. That's what I love about JCPenney. They have so many stylish and comfortable options that I always find just what I'm looking for there. Spring is a feel-good season and comes in all shapes, sizes, and colors. The fashion at JCPenney is the same way. refresh your wardrobe this spring with styles that gets you. Something to wear that fits your favorite moments of the season at prices that feel just as good. Discover brands that get you and put style and comfort first, like Worthington and Liz Claiborne for her, each in women's petite and plus sizes, and Stafford and Mutual Weave for him, style and comfort for all, even big and tall. Plus even more for the whole family, like Levi's and Exertion. Here, spring comes in all shapes, sizes, and colors. JCPenney, make everybody count.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
With AT&T in-car Wi-Fi, stay connected wherever you go and transform your vehicle into a dependable Wi-Fi hotspot. Powering applications like real-time GPS and voice assistant, navigation becomes a breeze. Even on the practice field, AT&T in-car Wi-Fi keeps you connected while in proximity of your vehicle. Work, stream shows, or finish homework without missing a beat. See if you're eligible for a free trial at att.com/in-car Wi-Fi. Don't let connectivity be a roadblock in your journey. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
In the late 19th century, the Brown family wasn't having a good time. They lived in Exeter, Rhode Island, which is a teeny tiny little town with a population of about 1,000. Much of its population had been decimated by the Civil War. And then after that, people started leaving to move out west, which, I mean, that makes sense. No offense to Exeter, but it was just like a bunch of rocks, had really terrible soil. And by the time that consumption reached the Brown family, Exeter was looking like a ghost town. People called it deserted Exeter. The first death in the Brown family was in 1883. The mom, Mary Eliza Brown, died of consumption. Then 7 months later, one of her daughters, 20-year-old Mary Olive, died of the same disease. The local newspaper said, quote, "The last few hours she lived was of great suffering, yet her faith was firm and she was ready for the change." I'm sure she was super ready for it. You know, a 20-year-old dying, they're always ready. But yeah, Mary Olive, she was a local dressmaker in town, and she was very popular, very beloved by everybody, so the whole town came out to her funeral. For a couple years after her death, no one in the Brown family showed signs of consumption. But then, oh no, Edwin, the only son, he started showing signs of consumption in 1890. He was getting weaker, had that rattling cough. He was a store clerk and was described as a big, husky man. One newspaper described him as a young married man of good habits. And here there's emphasis on good habits, because at the time, a lot of doctors and moralists and other people who had thoughts, they believed that the reason people got consumption was because of their own bad habits. Like, you know, if you had too much sex or too much food, too much alcohol, tobacco, or if you're just like weird and didn't exercise, or you danced too much. One doctor said that the cause of consumption was impure air, drunkenness, and want among the poor. So yeah, just be a better person. You won't get consumption. So with Edwin getting consumption, they're like, but he's such a good guy. How could he get it? Anyway, the dad of the Brown family, George, he was a farmer, and he was obviously very upset about his son having consumption. So he sent Edwin and Edwin's wife off to Colorado Springs. Why Colorado? Because Colorado was the destination for people with consumption, because lots of doctors thought that fresh air and high altitudes and plenty of sunshine could cure any disease. In fact, historians think that a third of Colorado's early settlers moved there because they had consumption. They had this whole wellness economy spring up with sanatoriums and nurses and doctors and all that jazz. When Edwin was there, it was probably bustling. Or bustling as much as people dying from consumption can bustle. But sadly, Colorado did not fix Edwin. His condition just got worse and worse over the 2 years he was there. And then he and his wife felt a longing for Rhode Island. Probably the first people ever to have that feeling. So he decided to return back to Exeter, back to what was left of his family. While Edwin had been away, his sister Mercy Lena became extremely ill. She's about 18 or 19 at this time, and she's being treated by Dr. Metcalf, a local physician who also serves as the medical examiner in the Exeter area. What a spooky doctor to have. He's like, I'll see you when you're alive and dead. Bye. Mercy Lena does not get the Colorado treatment because she has galloping consumption. You know, it gallops. It comes on real quick. Which, kind of weirdly, horses do come up from time to time when talking about TB. Like, along with galloping consumption, one of the treatments doctors would push at the time was horseback riding. Just riding a horse, coughing, just like, I guess. Of course, the horseback riding probably wasn't that effective. Other treatments were removing ribs, putting an incision in your chest wall to make your lungs collapse. I guess that's helpful. I don't know. Inhaling warm air, rubbing your chest with sulfuric acid, making this a mixture of brown sugar and water and drinking that. And then, of course, they had the classic bloodletting. A classic. But Dr. Metcalf, he says that any of these remedies, they will be of no help. There's no use in treating Mercy Lena because she is in the very last stages of the disease and will die soon. And indeed, she dies in January 1892, and she gets interned at the family vault at the Chestnut Hill Cemetery in Exeter. And she's in the vault because it's too cold to put her in the ground. You know, the ground is probably very frozen because, remember, it is Rhode Island in the wintertime. Anyway, back to Edwin. He arrives home in February 1892, a month after his sister died. One local newspaper wrote, "Our young fellow townsman, Eddie Brown, who had been tarrying at Colorado Springs about 2 years in pursuit of health, but without success, except temporarily at times, has returned to Rhode Island. He and his wife remained abroad until it became evident he could derive no more benefit there." End quote. So yeah, when he gets to Exeter, he's not doing well. He gets worse and worse. He even goes to see some relatives and friends, soliciting people to be his watchers, which was a New England ritual where people would find people to watch over them as they die to make sure that they are not alone until the end. Isn't that nice? But, you know, this kind of just shows that Edwin, at this point, he's resigned. He's going to die. But that's when the people of Exeter start telling Daddy George that maybe the reason Edwin is doing so badly now is because of Mercy Lena. They're like, yeah, as you know, obviously that gal is a vampire now, and she's the one who's making Edwin more and more sick, so you might as well, just to be sure, you might as well dig her up and see if she's got any blood in her heart, and you might as well dig up your wife and your other daughter too, you know, just to be safe, you know, just to be secure, because they might be vampires too. Now, Dad George, he just really wasn't into this theory. In fact, some people said he was appalled by it. He was like, my son is dying, and now you want me to dig up my dead wife and daughters? That's insane. Sounds like you're trying to make me feel bad. One newspaper wrote, "The husband and father of the deceased ones has, from first, disclaimed any faith at all in the vampire theory." But at the same time, Dad George, you know, he was probably at a loss. He'd lost his wife, he'd lost two of his kids, he didn't want to lose his son. So perhaps in an act of desperation, or perhaps just so he could appease the rest of his community, he made the decision and said, okay, fine, let's dig him up. But me and Edwin, we're not going to come, we're not going to watch what happens, but y'all do whatever y'all need to do. So in March 1892, 2 months after Mercy Lena died, a young man from Exeter goes to visit Dr. Metcalf, the doctor who had said there was no hope for Mercy Brown a few months earlier. And the young man tells him that he needs to come exhume the bodies of the Brown family and perform an autopsy to see if they are vampires. At first, Dr. Metcalf's response was similar to George. He was like, dudes, that is so stupid. I'm not going to do that. Okay, you silly country people, that's stupid. But then Daddy George, he made a personal request to get Dr. Metcalf to do the autopsy. So eventually he was like, fine, I'll do it. But just because he wants me to do it, not because you guys want me to. So on March 17th, 1892, Dr. Metcalf relents, comes to Exeter, and directs four dudes to go collect the bodies of the Brown family at the Chestnut Hill Cemetery. They start with the mom. She had died 9 years previously. So they dig her up. Dr. Metcalf looks over her corpse. She was mummified with some muscle and skin remaining, but there's no blood to be found in the organs. AKA, she could not possibly be a vampire feeding on her son. Then they dig up the other sister, who had died 8 years before. And all that remained of her was a skeleton and some hair. No blood in the organs, ergo, no vampire. And then there's Mercy Lena. She was in the family crypt, so they didn't have to dig her up. So Dr. Metcalf does his third autopsy, and when he looks at the organs, he does see clotted and decomposing blood in the liver and the heart. And he's like, guys, before you do anything crazy, I just want you to know that this is pretty normal decomposition stuff. Also, it's very cold outside. That is probably why she isn't that decomposed. It's only been like 2 months. But the vampire mob couldn't be stopped. The townspeople are like, oh my God, that is undeniable proof that she is a vampire. So what happened then? According to local newspapers, some Exeter townsfolk take the heart and the liver, go to the cemetery, and then they burn the organs on a rock until they are reduced to a pile of ash. But then they're not finished. The townspeople took the ashes from the heart and the liver, and then they mixed them in water for Edwin to drink. They're like, yes, drink down this cursed protein powder, and you shall be cured. 2 months later, Edwin dies. Was that womp womp sound inappropriate? Yes, but I also feel like your community peer pressuring you into digging up your dead relatives and then burning their organs is rude. So these sorts of vampiric rituals were happening across New England. But what was unique about the Mercy Lena Brown situation is that the story got picked up by the press. So local newspapers covered the whole saga, so it reached the ears of the people in the bigger cities. All this news coverage then got the attention of a notable anthropologist, George Stetson. I know, a notable anthropologist? I didn't know such a thing existed. So he went to a lot of small towns in Rhode Island and was like, let me see this, quote, barbaric superstition for myself. So he wrote about it. That just made more news. More people just going hee-hee, ha-ha, just guffawing at the whole thing. The news even went international. People were just like, scoff, scoff, look at what these silly people in the small towns are doing. Aren't they crazy? One journalist wrote about this vampire belief that, quote, perhaps the frequent intermarriages of families in these backcountry districts may partially account for some of their characteristics, end quote. So rude. The Mercy Lena story was so widespread that some people even think that it inspired the book Dracula, which was published in 1897. People are like, oh my God, there's a character in the book called Lucy, and Mercy Lena, if you take some of those letters and mix them around, you get Lucy. Oh my God, amazing literary analysis. But do you know what you also get when you do a selective anagram of Mercy Lena Brown? You get clown, you get yam, you get barleycorn, okay? That doesn't mean she was the inspiration for a book about barleycorn. But yeah, the whole story just sort of reflects this moment of superstition versus religion versus science, and everything was about to be turned on its head after germ theory. So back in Exeter, Edwin died, very sad. But George, the father, he actually never did contract tuberculosis. He died in 1922, which was the year after a tuberculosis vaccine was created. It started being used in the 1930s. And then during World War II, chemotherapy for TB was introduced, and that was a huge boon for treatments. And today, if you get it, you know, you get a bunch of antibiotics. As for Mercy Lena Brown, people like to visit her tombstone. They like to hear about the story of the vampires in New England. Actually, some people were such a fan of her that one time in 1996, the tombstone was taken out of the ground completely. But then it was returned the next day when everyone was like, hey, return that tombstone. Stop being a dick. So now an iron strap holds it down. Anyway, guys, this is American Filth. I think what we can learn from this episode is that, you know, unearthing your dead relatives is not going to cure any of your diseases. So maybe just do some reflection, do some self-care, go see a doctor. Thanks for listening. American Filth is a production of School of Humans and iHeart Podcast. This episode was written and hosted by me, Gabby Watts. The theme song is by me and Jesse Nyswanger. Our senior producer is Amelia Brock. Executive producers are Virginia Prescott, Elsie Crowley, and Brandon Barr. Halloween is my birthday, guys, so for a little present to me, please subscribe, like, leave a review, give us 5 stars at whatever platform you listen to this podcast on. Thanks so much. Bye.
School of Humans.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Awards Watch says Liam Neeson is at his best. Don't miss In the Land of Saints and Sinners. Having left his dark past behind, retired hitman Finbar Murphy, played by Neeson, leads a quiet life in a remote coastal Irish town. But when a menacing crew of terrorists arrive, Finbar is drawn into a vicious game of cat and mouse, forcing him to choose between exposing his secret identity or defending his friends and neighbors. In the Land of Saints and Sinners, from Samuel Goldwyn Films and Sony Pictures Home Entertainment. Watch it now on digital. Rated R.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cash back on purchases. And pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.